Okay, Destination Check, Francis Nataf, Rav Kook, Messianism and History, History and Messianism. I on some level, I feel like an imposter in this particular class. The name of the class sounds very pompous, and as if I'm a Rav Kook scholar, I want to make it clear that I'm not a Rav Kook scholar. I'll tell you in a minute my angle on Rav Kook, and when I say that, I'm not echoing Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, who at a lecture told us that he really couldn't comment on Yeshaya Leibovitz because he had no expertise on Yeshaya Leibovitz, even though he read every single word that he ever wrote, but he had no expertise. So when I say I have no expertise on Rav Kook, I'm not making a similar claim. There are many things of Rav Kook that I have not read. And on some level, I don't know if I was pushed into doing a machshava shiur, but it wasn't my thought. I was planning to come to a Tanakh conference where I feel more comfortable. And Rav Nati several times reminded me it's also a machshava conference and maybe you have something to say. And I do have things to say, usually my own thought, not so much other people's thought. But that wasn't on the program. Rav Nataf's machshava is not on the program, so I had to come up with something else. So I do have a shiur, I have several shiurim on Rav Kook. This is sort of a reincarnation of a shiur that I gave a few years back, and I realized, even though my source sheet in Tanakh was only in Hebrew, I didn't think twice about only putting this one in English, which I apologize if anybody is more comfortable in Hebrew would like to see the original. I do have the original citation, so you can look up the original sources. And for some of us, if you've ever studied any Rav Kook, you know that his Hebrew is extremely difficult. So at least for those of us who are not super duper fluent, so it makes it a little easier to read. So hopefully that's good for everyone. If it's not, you know, sorry. Anyway, what's my angle on Rav Kook? Why am I teaching Rav Kook at all if I haven't read through all of his works, or perhaps even a majority of his works? Rav Kook, as you know, wrote quite a bit. So to say that you haven't been through a majority of his works is not as bad as it sounds in other things. And I think that I do have a sense of his approach to many things. And on a personal level, I think Rav Kook was probably the most formative thinker on my own thinking through various teachers and through reading some of his works. So I have an appreciation on a personal level of the thought of Rav Kook, even if it's not necessarily a scholarly interest or appreciation. So I don't know if that's better or worse, but it's not scholarly, so that's what it is. And on some level, it's not clear exactly where Rav Kook's thought ends and my thought begins. Be aware there is some interplay there, and again, it's thought that I identify with on a personal level, so there could be a certain biased reading, but if you're a postmodernist, you know that all reading is biased. So, and if you're not, well... what can I do? In any case, the question is that I want to pose, that I want to discuss, is really how Rav Kook looks at history. And I think that it's a product of how he looks at everything, how he looks at his environment, he looks at the world as a whole. And the result of which we call in yeshiva the nafka mina is his approach to religious Zionism. I mean, Rav Kook is known as perhaps the greatest figure in the religious Zionist world. I've pointed out in other places that historically this didn't really have to be. There are different schools in religious Zionism. Certainly 60 years ago, when Rav Kook was alive, there were other voices. There had been other voices. For many in the religious Zionist world, and for not as many today, religious Zionism was very much a practical issue. There wasn't the sense of redemption, of Etchalta de Geula, that we generally in the religious Zionist camp associate with religious Zionism. It was very much an identification with Herzl's philosophy that the Jews needed a safe haven, and the Jewish people should be religious, so let's work within a religious context to bring about the safe haven. Not much more than that. The students of Rav Kook's son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, consciously or unconsciously took over the religious Zionist camps, especially in the educational institutions, and have really, again, for better or worse, and a particular version of Rav Kook's teaching, which is much influenced by his son. Those of you know something about the study of Rav Kook knows there's two main schools. One is the school of his son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda. Who's the other school of thought? Anybody know? Oh, good. That means I know more than you guys. That was just a test to see if anybody's an expert here. Okay. Okay, good. Now I can say whatever I want. What?
There's Machon and Mossad in Yerushalayim. Now, does that have anything to do with it?
I don't think so. The other great student of Rav Kook, Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kook, who we're talking about, is the Nazir. It's Nazir Rav Halep is also a big student, but in terms of main streams of thought, the Nazir, who is Shashav Cohen's father? Yeah, okay. Father, okay. Rav Shari Yashav Cohen, that's what I heard, and I always trip on that because he doesn't seem old enough, but I guess, okay, yeah. Okay, so Rav Shari Yashav Cohen is the chief rabbi of Haifa, has been for many years. His father, who has a very interesting biography, which is not really relevant for right now, but the Nazir has a much more universalistic reading of Rav Kook, the father's teachings, whereas Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, the son, has a much more nationalistic reading. And it's the students of Rav Tzvi Yehuda who have really taken over. The Nazir students are few and far between. You only hear about his reading basically in universities. Rav Amital of the Gush also is somewhat influenced by the Nazir's reading, but again, that's not really so relevant for us. Yeah.
Does he have a name?
Yes, I should know. He goes by Nazir. I don't know. He was a Nazir. Yeah, he was a Nazir, which is why they call him Nazir. Yeah, he took on the Zirut. What's interesting, we'll get back to what's interesting for our purposes, is that he came from the university world in Europe. He was at Baal Tshuva, and as a result, the relationship between him and Rav Kook was not one way. It was a symbiotic relationship. In any case, there are these two schools. This is all an aside, just to give you some background. The students of Yeshivat Merkaz Arav, which was for many years was under the sun, Rav Tzvi Yehuda, was a very popular place with tremendous passion about the teachings of Rav Kook, of the religious Zionism as Etchalta de Geula, which isn't Rav Kook, which we're going to speak about, but even more strongly about the importance of Eretz Yisrael Shleimah, of holding on to the messianic connection to the entire land of Israel, and so on and so forth. But the only reason I brought this up at all is simply to point out that for most religious Zionists today, religious Zionism is completely subsumed under this philosophy on some level or another that's associated with Eretz Yisrael. Even if you want to get away from territorial extremism, it's identified with the idea that the move back to Eretz Yisrael is the beginning of the Geulah, is the beginning of the redemption process. There was a hand, yeah.
That I'm not grasping the difference between the Nazir and Rav.
Yeah, because I didn't really express it. The Nazir is much more focused on Rav Kook. Rav Kook himself is a very complex thinker, has many things to say about many different topics. The difference is really one of focus. Rav Kook did speak about the importance of Eretz Yisrael, the redemption, and so on and so forth, but he also has a lot to say about the importance of the Jews' relationship, positive relationship to the other nations of the world, and the role in the nitzitzot, the sparks, the holy sparks that exist among other nations, and so on and so forth. So the question is really one of focus.
Is it fair to say that the son who was with his father, even when he was not publicly lecturing, would have more access to his father's truth?
Don't know. Yeah. So, okay, so the getting back to our issue, the question is, how did Rav Kook view history, and where does religious Zionism find itself in that worldview? In other words, why is Rav Kook, who is, sorry about that. turn off all cell phones. So where does it fit in? Why is Rav Kook a Zionist? If you look at his background, Rav Kook is part of the mainstream, what we call today, Haredi yeshiva world. I mean, he's connected to the Netziv is his Rebbe, even though Netziv also, some of you might know, had Zionist tendencies. But Netziv was mainstream as you could get. And perhaps by today's standards, he would be considered, you know, Chove style. I'm exaggerating, but nonetheless, he wasn't. And he was part of the yeshiva world, what we call the Aguda today. He was close to the Chafetz Chaim, right? He was straight out of the yeshiva world. And if you took away his thinking, I mean, obviously, that's a strange thing to say, but if you divorced him from thought, sociologically, Rav Kook was not a part of sort of this marginal community, sociological community that made up religious Zionism when it first started. He was right in the thick of things. So why did Rav Kook, and so obviously it has to do with his thought, right? It certainly wasn't sociological that he encouraged and gave tremendous philosophical background and support to religious Zionism. So what is it? So again, as I said, I think that to understand it, you need to have a better picture of Rav Kook's vision of existence as a whole, where there's a tremendous thirst for seeing God in everything. I'm going to refer back to Hegel later on, and because I think that there are some strong parallels between Hegel and Rav Kook in their views of history. But I'm going to quote from Hegel first. And I think what Hegel says is something that could have been said by Rav Kook. Hegel, of course, is Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, who is a philosopher whose main works were written in the first part of the 19th century in Germany. We'll talk a little bit more about him, but highly influential, especially concerning the philosophy of history. In any case, Hegel says as follows. So this is like this. It was for a while the fashion to profess admiration for the wisdom of God as displayed in animals, plants, and isolated occurrences. But if it be allowed that providence manifests itself in such objects and forms of existence, why not also in universal history? In other words, it's a very religious thought. That if God is present in the Bria, if God is the God of the natural world, God should also be the God of history. This is a theme that I discuss in other places about it. The Jewish tradition has something to say about it, that point. And then he goes on to speak about theodicy and say that, you know, we see bad things happen in history. So what do you do about that? Right? So again, this could be echoed by Rav Kook. He says, concerning history, nowhere is such a harmonizing view more pressingly demanded than in history. And it can only be attained by recognizing the positive existence in which the negative element is a subordinate and vanquished nullity. Okay, in other words, he's saying that if you understand history properly, which he wants to do clearly not only for lishma reasons, but also for religious reasons, then you see that things that look problematic in history end up being nullified by the larger picture, right? By the way, it's something that I've done that I've done in our school, the Cordoz Academy in Israel, is encourage people to study other religious philosophers outside of our tradition, because there's some insights there that help us, I think, in our tradition. Hegel is a valuable source, as is John Locke, who is a very important philosophical tradition for people here in the United States. But in any case, so Rav Kook, like Hegel, I think, is looking for God in history and is not willing to accept some sort of random process by which God's hester panim means that there is no rhyme or reason to the course of events. I think it's important before I get back to the thought of Rav Kook and how it connects with Hegel. It's important to bring out the point that what Hegel was considered to pioneer is the idea of directionality in history. Directionality means that we're heading somewhere, that there is progress, that things, again, even if there are setbacks, there is a general direction to history that can be understood on a rational level. That's not agreed by everyone. Hegel had his critics in his time, he has critics now, but, again, just as a thumbnail sketch, you should be aware that there are serious Hegelians out there who have a serious voice in the world. I know any of you have heard of Francis Fukuyama. A name sound familiar to anyone here? Okay. I don't bring him just because I like his first name. That's my first name also. He wrote a very important essay that he later turned into a book, which, again, in political philosophy circles is extremely well known. I think the president of Colombia, not the university, the country, was saying Chavez?
Yeah, Chavez?
Venezuela, okay. So I think he spoke against this essay in the United Nations. But in any case,
it must be good,
right? in any case, the essay is called The End of History, right? And the end of history, if you plug it back into what we said about Hegel, means that history is going towards an end, right? So Fukuyama claims that we got there already. He makes the following statement in the essay version, which is from 1989. He says, what we may be witnessing is not just the end of the Cold War or the passing of a particular period of post-war history, but the end of history as such, that is, the end point of mankind's ideological evolution and the universalization of Western liberal democracy as the final form of human government. Okay, it says Fukuyama, we've gotten there. As Hegel was right, and we're done. We're done with history. We're at the end of history. This was written before 9/11, but he still basically holds from this.
Because they call 9/11 the end of the end of history.
Right. Well, yeah. Well, Samuel Huntington, who most people probably heard of, is his what do you call it? His bar machloket. His foil. Okay. Is, you know, with the theory that you have this unbridgeable divide. Fukuyama is. It's interesting. He's not happy about this, by the way. It's very funny. He's a Hegelian, but he's also a Nietzschean. So he's got this angst. It's a very, very strange combination for those who know much about Nietzsche and Hegel. But in any case, he still basically holds from this. He holds that eventually, as others do as well, eventually the Arab world will come around, and everybody, you know, it's a process. And the end of history means that we're at that stage where most have come around, and eventually the rest will as well. That's what Fukuyama says. Again, it's not so relevant. All I'm pointing out is that Hegel is still alive. Okay? So, because I remember speaking about Hegel in one shul, and someone telling me, what do you mean Hegel? Who cares about Hegel? Hegel's dead. You know? So I don't know. I don't think he's as dead as some would have him.
Influence Hirsch too, right?
Sorry?
Didn't he also influence Hirsch, censoring for Hirsch? Or?
Maybe, I don't know. Not that I'm aware of, but I'm sure Hirsch was aware of Hegel. I shouldn't say I'm sure. It would make sense that he would be aware of Hegel's thought. Okay. Okay. So that was that. That Rav Kook would be influenced by Hegel, as I said, is not, I mean, it's speculation on my part. I haven't seen anyone write about it. It's certainly not extant in the writings of Kook that I've seen, as opposed to Darwin and other. There are other people that Rav Kook was clearly aware of, some by name, some not by name. There's no clear reference to Hegel in, again, the works of Rav Kook that I've seen, but I'm speculating that through the Nazir that Rav Kook heard about the idea, the directionality of history, specifically a history that develops in stages, one stage building upon the other, towards perfection. Whether you reach that perfection, as in Fukuyama, or not, is not clear in my reading of Hegel, for whatever that reading is worth. In any case, Rav Kook echoes what we are surmising is influence by Hegel. By the way, before I get to that, for Hegel, the road that one is moving towards, he calls freedom. Freedom for Hegel is a philosophical concept. In Fukuyama, it's freedom, but it's much more a political concept. So just for our information. For Rav Kook, obviously, the endpoint is much more theological. We're talking about tikkun olam. We're talking about a true sense of God awareness among all peoples, a messianic concept. But in any case, as I was starting to say, Rav Kook doesn't speak about Hegel, but does speak about Darwin. And the process that I'm outlining of seeing God's hand in the physical world, which Hegel speaks about in human history, Rav Kook saw more clearly in natural history, meaning in evolution. It's interesting because Hegel himself, it's hard for me to imagine that he wasn't aware of Darwin. I don't know how popularly Darwin was accepted. It's about the same time. Could be that it wasn't really accepted. Is it because Hegel says that you don't have progress in natural history? He doesn't say. He says nature just goes around in circles, right? But history, on the other hand, that moves forward. So for Rav Kook, history does move forward, that's correct, but his smach, his support, wasn't from Hegel, but rather from Darwin. And he says something amazing about evolution, which you have on your sheet in front of you.
Hegel?
Sorry?
Wasn't Darwin a little bit after Hegel?
Was he?
He says, wasn't Darwin like late 1800s as opposed to Hegel, he's saying was early?
What was the origin of species? I think it was earlier. Yeah.
Wasn't it 1847?
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah, yeah. So the question is whether he had published anything before that. So that, okay, that makes sense. I mean, so presumably even if he had published other things, it didn't really... Yeah, yeah. Okay, so that, okay, works. Fine. By the way, Darwin's not the first one to speak about evolution. Lamarck is, so the idea was around... But you're right, that Darwin was the one that really made it famous. So, okay, so that's fair. Hegel's off the hook. We're good. Okay. In any case, Rav Kook, however, being in the 20th century, was aware, again, presumably through the Nazir, and says the following statements in Orta Kodesh. It's a little mamar, little piece on evolution. And interestingly enough, Rav Kook is really into evolution, but not from a scientific perspective, but rather from a religious perspective. So listen to what he says. The doctrine of evolution is more similar to the Kabbalah than all other philosophies. Evolution, which proceeds on a course of improvement, offers us the basis of optimism in the world. In probing the inner meaning of evolution towards an improved state, and again, the inner meaning is what he's after, we find here an explanation of the divine concepts with absolute clarity. It is precisely the Ein Sof in action, right, God in action, that manages to bring to realization the infinite potentiality. Again, the infinite potentiality is a phrase you could have seen in Hegel as well. Evolution sheds light on all the ways of God. All existence evolves and ascends as this may be discerned in some of its parts. Rav Kook says, clearly, everybody sees things that don't look like they're progressing, even in natural history, right? Dinosaurs get extinct. But presumably that has an important role in the creation, in the further creation of the world. In any case, its ascent is general, as well as its in its particulars. Existence is destined to reach a point when the whole will assimilate the good in all its constituted particulars. Right? Read Yamot HaMashiach. Right? You know, there's nature, right? Lion and lamb type things, right? That's where we're going in the natural world. This is its general ascent. No particularity will remain outside. Perfection, in other words, will be attained. Not a spark will be lost from the ensemble. All will share in this climactic culmination.
Your translation?
It is, actually, yeah. I don't know if that's good or bad, but yeah, that's what you get. Thank you. Okay. I think it is, isn't it? Now, you know what? No, it's not. I'm sorry. This is not. I translated something else. This is not my translation. It is from the Western Spirituality series. I might have changed a word here and there, but I can't take credit. Okay. In any case, Rav Kook is excited about evolution because evolution is a sort of unchallenged Hegelianism. As evolution, you can test on the ground. Hegel's an idea. You're for it, you're against it. But evolution, granted, in the Orthodox world, it's controversial, but outside the world, it's pretty much, you know, with a little tweaking here and there, maybe major tweaking, but it's viewed and has been viewed as pretty much established science almost since the time of Darwin. So here you have something that proves that the world is progressing. By the way, the philosophy of science, that's also debated. But to the intuitive person, you can pretty much feel confident that there's some advance between one-celled creatures and man. Okay, again, philosophy, like everything's up for grabs. And who says that man is more adaptive? You know, why is man better? But again, I think I'm happy to be intuitive on this point. So yeah, that evolution is really progressive, that there's advance in the various species that move further down the chain. Okay, anyway, so Rav Kook has the smach of evolution to get to his perspective on history, which is going to be similar to that of Hegel's. But obviously he's going to want to plug it in to the facts of Jewish history. Right? He's viewing Jewish history as the most central facet of human history. Rav Kook is able to see into what otherwise very difficult to explain, some sort of process that leads to a geula. He is able to interpret the events of his time, interpret correctly or incorrectly, but he, based on his system, he's able to interpret the events of his time, what precedes him, and how he views, again, religious Zionism as the beginning of a new messianic period. So for Rav Kook, you have two major periods. You have two major periods. This is brought out, by the way, in the article that I've quoted for you, where Chacham Gadol Min Avi, Sage is Greater Than Prophet, which is an Orot, as well as in Derech HaTchiya, which is a longer essay, which includes a more lengthy explanation of how history has worked in the, well, basically since the beginning of Jewish history. In any case, Rav Kook sees two major periods, if you want a thesis and antithesis, which is followed by the grand synthesis of Messianic times. And he views those two periods as identified with, we could call the prophetic period and the period of the sages. Right? The article we have in front of us, the next quote is from a book called, from an article rather called, Chacham Gadol Min Avi. Right? So there's the period of the Chachamim, and there's the period of Nevi'im. Right? And he says that in early Jewish history, right, certainly through the First Temple and basically into the Second Temple period as well, right, prophecy not being defined strictly as in the type of prophecy that's written in the Tanakh, but rather by a sort of large level inspiration. Right, the period of the prophets is the sort of grand idea that inspires, that tells people, you know, there's a God in the world, and God is the creator of beauty, and God is the creator of truth, and God is the one who expects a tremendous level of morality, and such that murder is anathema, such as theft and not treating your neighbor properly is something that's not consonant with living in front of God. The great ideas, right? My friend Gideon Rothstein talks about Rav Shlomo Kaulbach, giving an example of that and seeing, you know, how that follows through to the practical world. He was at some Shabbos thing, whatever, so a lot of people, and he's telling them all, okay, guys want world peace, right? So they're very excited, you know, there's a rabbi talking about world peace, now a lot of rabbis speaking about world peace, yeah, I want to hear about world peace. So world peace, right? Yeah, world peace, and you know, he's got them into a frenzy, they're all excited, what's he going to say? So you really want world peace? Yeah, I want world peace. So he said, think of a person you really, really despise. Do something nice to them. I said, that's world peace. The problem is going from the great inspiration, which is naturally interesting and exciting, to the particulars. Everybody wants world peace, or most people want world peace. But very few of us want to be nice to the people that we hate. Period of the sages is essentially bringing the great ideas down to their practical implementation. Okay? So Rav Kook, it's very interesting, but maybe we'll read from this a little bit. He says that there was a synthesis in one man, and that man was Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu was a synthesis of the great idea and the details. He says as follows, and he plays right, Lo Yak Moshe, right, he plays on that idea that there never will be another Navi Kamoshe B'Yisrael, right, the end of Sefer Dvarim. he says that this phenomenon was granted to Moshe. I'm reading from the second item here. Prophecy of undimmed clarity that discerned simultaneously the claims of general principles, that we're talking about the great ideas, as well as the exacting demands of the particulars. But there never arose another like Moshe. It was therefore needed to assign the general principles to the prophets and the particulars to the sages. But as Rav Kook points out, historically, there's a division of labor. And it had to be this way. You can't start from the particulars. You have to start from the great idea. No one's going to get excited about, okay, you know, if your ox gores a cow, so you have to pay this, right? Excited? Let's all do it. No one's interested. You have to start from the great ideas. Once a person is interested in the great ideas, then they go to the Beit Midrash and let's see what this means practically on the ground. So in history also, there's this incubation period of the great idea, which Rav Kook points out is on the ground not so successful. In other words, it's really an incubation period because idol worship is still around. Idol worship is not erased because there's no strategy to erase it. There's simply inspiration and excitation. So therefore, there's a need to go away from the great idea. So long as people are focused and absorbed and mesmerized by the great idea, who wants to sit in a Beit Midrash? Right? Who wants to go sit and learn? Open a Gemara. You've got a Navi. You've got Yeheskel. You have Eliyahu Navi on Har Carmel. It's a great show. Right? No one's going to go inside and learn Rav Chaim. It's just not interesting. So therefore, there's a need to sublimate this experience and to focus on the Beit Midrash. And even though Rav Kook speaks about this period as even starting from the Second Temple period, and perhaps in this I'm reading a little bit into Rav Kook, I understand this to be identical with the Galut. With the Galut, when the Jews are not only divorced from the great idea of the prophet, but also the great idea of a state. They're divorced from a system that has to functions, a state presents itself as a great idea. In fact, if you look in Hegel, Hegel's in love with the state. For Hegel, the state is one of these absolute values. I shouldn't say absolute values, but cardinal value for Hegel. So it appears that it's necessary to take the Jews into, as the Gemara says, into the Dalet Amot of Halacha. And they have to work it out. They have to work out the details. And says Rav Kook, that was more successful than the first period. But there's a problem with it. The problem is that eventually your original inspiration wears out. Right? In other words, you have to go in the Beit Midrash, but you have to go there inspired. And if you sit there too long, right, eventually you lose your inspiration. So it's interesting. I mean, that period went on for 2,000 years, says Rav Kook, Po Vasham, there was a little inspiration, right? It's very interesting. He sees, as I said, he's looking for the positive in everything, and he sees Jesus and other false messiahs as having a positive as well as a negative side. And the positive side is an infusion of the spiritual excitement, and as a reminder that the great idea exists, even if it's not exactly the right great idea, or it has an admixture of something very inappropriate. Okay? But nonetheless, there comes reminders from time to time that the great idea exists because, and it's a beautiful description of this in Derech Tchiya, because we become weary, our bones become dry. We lose our sense of inspiration. Says Rav Kook, the Messianic times is when the two will come back together. Let's look back at this reading, right? First, he speaks about the end of this period of time of the sages. He says, in the course of time, the concern with the work of the sages. Historical period number two, right? In the course of time, the concern with the work of the sages predominated over the work of the prophets. Read Galut. At the end of the present epoch, when the light of prophecy will begin to have its revival, there will develop a reaction, a pronounced disdain for the particulars. Here Rav Kook is referring to real events. What's he referring to? Who's upset about the particulars? Who's revolting against them? Secular Zionists for one, right? Who else? Communists, socialists, Reform Judaism. Yeah, well, all the Jewish movements that come out of it, right? All the Jewish movements that are influenced and inspired by the Enlightenment and the ideological movements that follow. So, yeah, there's a tremendous impatience among Jews living in Rav Kook's time with halacha. You know, here halacha, you know, there's this great idea of settling the land, and these Jews are just, you know, studying the same thing about these little details. Right? Rav Kook speaks a lot about that, about the importance of the great idea, which is perhaps one of the reasons he's speaking so much about it, is because he feels that there's a need for it. And as people, even in the religious Zionist camp, there is a sense that we need to focus on the great idea. How can we just focus so much on Netilat Yadayim, right? We're spending hours and hours on Netilat Yadayim, and, you know, Jewish revival, okay, yeah, it's interesting, I'll read about it, you know, in the bathroom, you know, in the newspaper. It's not that interesting. So Rav Kook is saying that this is a natural part of history, and again, Hegel speaks about this also. How does one historical period lead to another? With a certain breakdown that occurs within the components that form the reality of a historical period that have its own self-destruction within itself. He compares it to the mythical phoenix. I don't know how many of you have heard of the phoenix. The phoenix sets the pyre to light itself on fire, and from its ashes a new being is created, right? Hegel speaks about this. Rav Kook, perhaps in less dramatic fashion, would also speak about the contradictions that exist within historical period. By the way, you may be familiar with some of these ideas from Marx. Marx borrowed from Hegel very strongly in terms of his understanding of history. But in any case, we're not dealing with Hegel, we're not dealing with Marx, but rather with Rav Kook, who sees Jewish history as going through these stages. He's looking for God in the general flow, realizing, as does Hegel, that there are these, I forgot what he called them, that the negative elements, right, what would he say? The negative element that does exist in history is subordinate and ultimately a vanquished nullity. That in the larger picture, even the great cataclysm, even the Churban HaBayit, even the Shoah, is part of this grand picture. But to move from one period to another usually involves some sort of cataclysmic event, or at the very least, some very severe turbulence. Right? And so for Rav Kook, the Reform Movement, the secular or Zionism's anti-religious flavor in most of its history, certainly from the Second Aliyah through up till Begin, the general thrust of Zionism was very much anti-religious. So Rav Kook, that's understood. It's clear that had to be, right? We're not going to get to Mashiach if people are going to stay in the Beit Midrash. Because, sorry, yeah, that's right. Chutzpah yasper. That there will be chutzpah in the world. That there will be more chutzpah as, I mean, the Rebbe Martyr is referring to a statement in Chazal and Sota, that in the time of the Mashiach, so all sorts of strange things will occur. So that's true. We have in the classical sources, but for Rav Kook, it's not just a sort of isolated event, but rather it's part of a rational process that starts from the beginning of the revelation of Moshe Rabbeinu being this quasi or this pre-messianic figure who has both components in him. He's able to inspire, and at the same time he's able to teach the details. But Moshe is sui generis. He's his own class. There's no one like him. So therefore, Jewish history has to play out these separate items on their own. And there has to be a being fed up with the great idea. At some point, the leaders of the generation say, you know, we've got these great ideas, we're not getting anywhere. At least we're worshipping idols. People are inspired, but they're inspired to do all sorts of things. They're so spiritual that, you know, they have to worship at Bamot. You can't control them, tell them, go to Yerushalayim. And, you know, even if they're too far away, they want to worship something else. They're into worship. So there's a crackdown, both from on top and from below. It's like, okay, now we have to get to the particulars. We're overly inspired, and we're not rigorous enough. So let's get rigorous. And for a couple thousand years, there's this rigorousness which eventually drowns out the great message. And at the end of this period, before the two can come together, says Rav Kook, there has to be a sense of we're parched, which I very much relate to, the sense that we're so much in the Beit Midrash that we've completely forgotten the large idea. And the first reaction, says Rav Kook, is to want to abandon the details, which is what he ascribes to these movements. But says Rav Kook, that's not a permanent situation. Which is interesting, right? Exactly why it's a certain inspired view. One could take a different view. If one were not someone who saw directionality in history, as does Rav Kook and does Hegel, both religious figures, one could say, well, you just go back and forth. Right? You go from one to the other, one to the other, one to the other, and it doesn't go anywhere. But Rav Kook, as well as Hegel, are infused with a sense of God. And it's almost a priori that there is direction. That's, by the way, for Rav Kook, why evolution is so exciting. Because here, as I said, even though people do argue, it seems that there is nothing to argue about. Okay? But in history, he's going to assume that God's hand is there in the same way that Hegel speaks very much about God's hand in history, and sees this reaction against the particulars as the introduction to the Messianic period, translated, as we do, as Ithalta the Geula, the beginning of the Messianic times. Okay, let's read the last stanza in this. Right? Yeah, sure.
Bogged down in the particulars and not inspired by.
Yeah, the period is old. The period of the sages begins in the Second Temple period with Ezra and the Anshei Knesset Gedolah going to the period of the Gemara. He speaks about losing that sense already in the Talmudic period, losing the great idea already at that time.
He doesn't see it as a come and go. He sees it as
progression
towards that balance which would be of the Messianic time.
Put it this way. He, like Hegel, he sees small ups and downs. Mm-hmm. And as he speaks about, as I mentioned before, Shabbat Tzvi, and Havdil speaks about Rabbi Akiva, someone who's trying to bring back the great idea. I mean, so he's talking about Kabbalah over there. So he does speak about small waves, but they're small movements and they're big movements. And as far as the big movement, he's saying that the second large period is starting to end in his time. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm thinking about this exactly the observations that he had are very connected to Ashkenazi Jewry and not necessarily to what was going on in the world.
I don't know. I'm not sure. Again, he identifies Hasidut as part of the end of the second time period as a reaction also. Now, there are reactions, there are secular or antinomian reactions, but there are also reactions within the halachic world. And there's the threat for the mitnagdim was that Hasidim were stressing the big idea, or big ideas at the expense of particulars. So it identifies that. But I think even the Hasidic world and the Sephardic world also, the center still, I mean, granted, there's discussion of the great ideas. We're not talking about total, in either period. When we're talking about the prophetic period, we're not saying there was no halakha whatsoever. The emphasis was on the big idea. In the second period, the emphasis is on the particulars. And there's ups and downs, and there are regional variations, but I think, by and large, I think he's correct that the focus really is on study and halakha. Let me just finish, and then I can open up a few minutes for questions. So let's get to the climax, the Messianic times, the last paragraph. This will continue, he says, until the radiance of prophecy will reemerge. Like they say about Rav Kook, that he himself was trying to train himself for prophecy. It's been said about other Hasidim, or Hasidim, he's not really a Hasid, but other great scholars, rabbis also. But in any case, he says the prophecy will reemerge, not as unripe fruits, but as the first fruits of vitality in life. And prophecy itself will acknowledge the great efficacy in the work of the sages, and in righteous humility exclaim, this is a quote from Bala Batra, the sage is greater than the prophet. This transcending of one-sidedness, as interesting phrasing, transcending of one-sidedness, people will see the value of the other side, will vindicate the vision of unity expressed by the psalmist, mercy and truth have met, justice and peace have kissed, right? Being identified with the different things that we've mentioned. Truth will rise out of the earth and mercy will show itself from heaven. The Lord will also bestow what is good and our earth will bring forth its bounty. And he says this beautiful line, the soul of Moshe will reappear in the world. Now, this is what we're looking forward to. It's a fantastic vision. Whether, again, it's accurate or not, perhaps we can determine. The state of Israel ideologically is not as interesting as it was. Rav Kook lived before the state of Israel, but the idea of the state was ideologically more interesting. People say we live in post-Zionist times, which means post-ideological times. So on some level, it's hard to see the vision. But as I said before, Rav Kook was much more sophisticated than simply to say, look at the New York Times and you can see whether what I'm saying is true or not. But rather, there are ups and downs. And whether he was right in seeing the Messianic times around the corner or not, in Hasidut and religious Zionism, as a precursor of this grand synthesis of halakha and the great idea or not, doesn't mean that it's not eventually going to happen. So I'll take questions. I just want to explain why this is so interesting to me. Is, first of all, the ability, the words of Hegel resonate very strongly, and I don't think what I read, but saying that it's appropriate for a person to try to see God in their world. I think this is perhaps a teaching that exists in my Judaism anyways. And he say about Emmanuel Rachman, he called his book One Man's Judaism, and people used to say, thank God it's only one man's. So I don't know if this is my Judaism or true Judaism, but certainly what I believe to be true Judaism is that one of the things that is intrinsic to the religious personality is to try to see God's hand in the world, both in the natural world as well as in the world of history and politics. And if it doesn't match exactly what we're seeing on a day-to-day basis, at least in the long term, we're talking about very, very long historical periods, it gives us a religious perspective that I think is at least sound and reasonable into history. And it also gives us a little more foundation for our religious Zionism, which at sometimes many of our beliefs and thoughts can be very shallow. So I think it's important to have this sort of background in understanding of at least where Rav Kook was coming from in his Zionism, that not only explains history, but helps us see religious Zionism as, and the return to Eretz Israel, as something that makes sense in this grand design. So I'll take questions if there are any. Yeah, go ahead.
This is not about Zionism, but is that something that here, sorry, another idea to me, and that is separation is presumably refers to Tanakh, and the particulars refers to Torah Sheba'al Peh. So does Rav Kook here or elsewhere recommend any kind of distribution of your time when you're learning to study of Tanakh versus
Torah Sheba'al Peh
in order to, because it seems to me that in the you stress Torah, if you only learn Torah Shabbat Sav, you don't learn the particulars, you don't learn how to implement. And if you only learn how the particulars about implement, Shabbat 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 division of learning in terms of that everybody should continue keeping the inspiration going, so to speak?
Yeah. So your train of thought makes a lot of sense, and Rav Kook does speak about pedagogy, but I'm not clear on what he says. That's one of the areas that I have not really investigated. Anything else? Okay, it's fun. There's more information about our institute if anybody wants to know, or to get weekly emails from us, articles of big ideas as well as particulars. Thank you.
Do you think that if global warming were the dominant scientific issue of the day instead of Darwinism, that we would have had a
such a... People ask a different question. People ask, would Rav Kook still been Rav Kook had he seen the Holocaust?
Right.
And to me, it's clear that he would have. But that, again, that's my reading of Rav Kook.
It
was too intrinsic to his worldview not to even... I don't think he would have even been surprised. He would have been very saddened. But I don't think he would have been surprised by it, by sure.
But along with global warming, is a dark vision of the end of days. Of course, was to stop it.
Yeah. What's interesting, we talk about natural history. I mean, people speak about, astronomic level, the Earth falling apart, and that's the scientific vision there. So even though in our natural ecosystem there's progress, so people could say, well, what about... In a billion years, we're all gonna die.
Okay. Well, you at least brought a few years with the new mileage standard the Senate approved. So,
we're gonna better mileage.
In regards to the premise that the scientific community necessarily holds by evolution, I think what I'll offer is nothing that competes with the main thrust.
Right.
The idea of an end in history or towards progression of positivity where there's some kind of improvement. I think that I'm sensitive to the issue, partly because we teach evolution in our biology class in ninth grade, and one of the fathers who's a scientist was particularly exercised over the nature of what we were teaching, that we should just glibly teach evolution in the classroom and not present an equally strong argument demonstrating its holes and its flaws.
Mm-hmm.
And he showed me article after article and a whole lot of literature.
He's in that field? Or
No, but he's actually, I think, into physics engineering, but in terms of biology, what he was showing me were seemingly a lot of scientists moving the community towards. It's an evolution, a progression towards improvement, but it's not slow and naturally progressive.
Okay.
It's a step function. And he, of course, would like to argue that that's Yad Hashem, the historical process. And he's trying to show through these articles that many in the scientific community who are avowed agnostics or atheists are grappling with this because they don't have enough theory to really put together the facts.
It's tough. I mean, you're in a no-win situation. But
for the purpose of the presentation, it doesn't matter either way.
The correct, but I believe that I'm presenting an accurate view of the scientific community as a whole, at least as I understand it. Not on Slifkin, the Zoo Rabbi.
He's coming to Washington.
So he teaches for us. And we asked him about intelligent design. He says no. Yeah, he says Yad Hashem, 100%. Intelligent design, no. He says that's not the scientific community. It's not holding by that. Is there machloket? Yes, machloket. Mm-hmm. Are there problems with the theory? As a layman, I understand, like you have seen, that there are some problems. But the scientific community as a whole still holds by it. And it's really, you know, I see it to be in their hands. And I'm going to be neutral on that. I'm not, you know, if I were in your school, I wouldn't be necessarily against teaching intelligence design. I think, you know, there's something to be said for it. But
well,
I think
you say the scientific community, that's not the standard.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Stephen Jay Gould talks about punctuated evolution in a very intelligent way.
Yes, but it's after that article that my
third class of today is completed.
Has written the literature.
Third class
at the Shrinks.
Yeah.
The next class will begin at
the end. Prophet is there for the purpose, you know,
those who are
of the Shemite one. Is there in order to generate light down on the heat? And that's the whole point. You know, 100 years from now, you know, when I was studying political science and political philosophy 40 years ago, so we were reading books about the end of ideology, right? And sometimes I wish I could sit down with my professors today.